which is what we'll be responsible for. We're looking at Genesis 3. And if you know the flow of Genesis, you know Genesis 3 is the fall. We're going to start in Genesis 2 and get the picture. Soon after creation. In fact, as God created, during creation, God plants a garden. We call it a garden. Don't think a backyard size, you know, nice little cute garden. No doubt it was acre upon acre of trees and fields, vines, shrubs. Everything beautiful, everything flowering. Again, the climate would probably be something subtropical. So there's always something in bloom. There's always something to eat. As time goes by and the blossoms of one tree fade into fruit and fruit ripens, another tree is or vine or shrub is flowering. And so there's always color. There's always scent. It's an absolute gorgeous, enormous paradise that God created for our first parents. We're told that in this garden is a spring, or a river flow. So a spring is in this garden, apparently. And there's a stream that meanders throughout this garden, providing water for the trees, the plants, the shrubs, providing water for the animals and our first parents that are there. And the stream, it says, becomes four rivers, the headwater of four mighty rivers that flow throughout land. So beyond the garden, there are lands of brimming with wealth, with beauty, with undiscovered riches and bounty. So this garden that God has put in place is the center, in a very real sense, the center of the world, if you will. There's the headwaters of the rivers. That's where he's placed our parents. Incredible paradise that he's created for them. He gives them work. There's work to do. If you've tended a garden, you know it's work. But in that day, tending the garden, it didn't seem like work, no doubt. Surrounded by that level of beauty and gathering that bounty was not drudgery. But they would be, no doubt, gathering fallen fruit so it didn't rot in place. They'd be pruning bushes and trees, maybe moving bushes to create a new path or to create a better arrangement. So this whole thing is a work of art, a work of the gardener's art. And all day, every day, they're living in their dream. They're working, they're joyfully tending the garden they've been given. But in this garden, in the very center of the garden, God places two trees. And in my mind, the trees are huge, towering over the other trees. I'm imagining a meadow in the center of this garden with these trees in the middle. I don't know if that's what it was or not, but in my mind, we have these two enormous trees with the river, with the stream between them. And we know that one is the tree of life. And this tree has fruit and leaves that heal. In Revelation, we're told the tree of life's in heaven, and it says there the leaves are for the healing of the nations. So somehow this tree has medicinal qualities so that you go and you eat of the fruit or possibly the leaves as well of this tree, and life is restored and health is restored and you're brought back into perfect health and vitality from the tree of life. On the other side of the stream is a tree of knowledge. A tree that offers a depth of understanding of good and evil. A depth of understanding things that our parents have no concept of at this point. The first tree, the tree of life, they go to, they eat regularly. This is a place they would go and periodically, if they hurt themselves in any way, they would go and eat there. Or just, this would be a place they would go regularly to eat. The other tree, God told them, don't eat from it, don't tend it. Later, Eve said, we're not to touch it. And no, she wasn't lying. She wasn't making something up. I think that reflects the idea they are to leave it completely alone. So their work of tending the garden does not include this one tree. At the center of the garden, in my mind, there is an untended, wild tree growing. And all around it, the garden, this incredible acres and acres, show all the signs of manicured care, of love, of being tended carefully. Leaves are cleaned away. Fruit is taken away when it falls. Bushes are pruned. Things are cleared. But this one tree stands untended and wild right in the center of the garden. It's the only spot of neglect, intentional neglect, but they're not touching the tree. So every time they go to the tree of life, every time they're in the center of the garden, they are reminded that some things are off limits. They're reminded that they are not sovereign, that they're responsible to God. And God has said, don't touch that tree. Somehow, in some way, they don't understand that tree, and the knowledge that that tree offers is a special property of God. And he has said, do not touch that tree. Leave that one alone. That one's mine. Don't touch it. And they're okay with that. There's only one restriction after all. It's a minor restriction. Leave that one tree alone. So they go about life. And life goes on. God knows what he's doing. If he says to leave this tree alone, they'll leave it alone. Not a problem. Because he has given them an entire world to explore. There's no other boundaries in their lives. But I imagine that as they look at that tree, there's a sense of awe, maybe a sense of nervous curiosity. There are things we don't know. There are things we are not to touch. But the main reminder is that God is in control. God is sovereign. And that's okay. There are mysteries in the world. They'll leave those mysteries to God and spend their time exploring the incredible, almost limitless wonders God has provided for them. And life goes on. We don't know how long. We have no concept how long. It may have been a few weeks. It may have been a century they lived this way. In paradise, time is not a taskmaster. In paradise, time is your friend. It flows quietly. Maybe there's an exciting time. No doubt there's exciting discoveries that they're making. But time flows on, a balance of harmony and perfection in paradise as our first parents are there. But there's things happening they don't know about. There's things they don't see going on. And one thing that happens that they have no concept of is that in the spiritual world, an enemy has arisen who opposes God, who wants to overthrow God. And finding that impossible, the enemy then chooses to strike not at God directly, he can't do that, but at what God loves, and so to strike him indirectly. And so this enemy enters the garden, takes control of one of the animals, probably a small animal, but we're told it's shrewd, it's cunning, it's crafty. So the enemy takes control of a serpent and waits to find a way to attack God. In my mind, he finds his chance when the woman's alone, when Eve is maybe resting in the shade somewhere, and the serpent comes up to a nearby tree and starts talking to her. Well, put yourself in Eve's place for a moment. You know Adam's voice. You know his voice very well. You know the voice of God, because God comes and walks with you and talks with you. Suddenly there's an unfamiliar voice talking to you, and she looks around and, where is this coming from? And she sees the snake, and the snake's looking right at her and is talking to her. Well, I think her mind is in a whirl. What is going on? There's no indication the animals could talk in that time. But before she figures that out, she starts hearing what this snake is saying to her. And I think the record we have is a condensed record. It's a summary. Perhaps the discussion kind of took this line. We animals, the snake might say, we eat from certain trees, from certain areas. The monkeys eat fruit. The squirrels eat nuts. The horses eat grass. But you humans seem to eat whatever you want. Is that true? Do you just eat whatever you want of everything around you? And she says, yes, we eat anything we want. There's no restrictions except one. There's only one. There's one tree we don't eat, but that's it. Other than that, we eat whatever we want, wherever we want. And then comes the real question. That's the opening the serpent's looking for. And he says, you mean God restricts you from one tree? You mean God has told you not to touch this one tree? And she says, yeah. We eat from any of the trees except for that one neglected tree in the center of the garden. God's forbidden us to eat from that tree or to touch that tree, to tend that tree, to have anything to do with that tree, because that tree is death. And the serpent responds, no. No, that tree is not death. You're not surely die. But when you eat that fruit, you will gain a clearer perspective, a deeper understanding. You'll be like God. You will understand the one thing God has not given you, the understanding of good and evil. That's what that tree is. It's not death. And in my mind, and I think there's a little evidence for this, I think she turns away from the serpent. This is a big jump for her. And so she goes about her work. Now, before you get stuck on that, because all the stories we hear are the snake is in the tree, okay? But when I was reading through this, and actually I was thinking that, then I noticed she said, the tree in the center of the garden. She didn't say, this tree. So apparently, they're not at that tree. She has to describe what tree it is. The tree in the center of the garden, that tree over there, that's the one we're not to touch. Which suggests there's some time elapses. We're just given the details. We're given the skeleton of the story. If you're in paradise, and you have a perfect relationship with your husband or wife, you don't keep secrets. So personally, I can't prove this, but personally, I think Eve discusses it with Adam. They get together. They talk it over. Those words, you will not die. You will be like God. They just keep playing over and over in her mind. Because wasn't she created in God's image? I mean, she and Adam are that what sets them apart from the animals. They're created in God's image. So maybe this is her destiny. What if there's more that she can discover that can make her more like God? Why would God place something in the center of her garden, the center of her world, and then forbid her from having it? What if it was a test? What if God actually wanted them to eat that fruit? What if God wanted them to find their independence? And the only way to do that is to step out on their own. Maybe God says, no, don't eat it, but secretly wants them to. And believe it or not, that is a teaching that a number of people walk away from this story with, saying, hey, they actually wanted, God wanted them to. This wasn't what they were supposed to do. Well, it's not at all what it says, and God's reaction doesn't indicate that at all. But that is actually a teaching today, is that, yeah, eating the fruit was good. We were supposed to go ahead and make that step. Well, if that was the way people think today, it's not too much of a stretch to think maybe that's part of what she was thinking at that time. Maybe that final step of independence is what God actually intended. God gave us the ability to make choices. Why should we not make the choice? And then, of course, there's a question of how is a serpent talking? This is weird. Maybe Maybe the serpent ate the fruit. And if that fruit gave a serpent the ability to talk, what would it do for a human? Well, Adam apparently remains opposed to it. He's not convinced anyway. But Eve gets used to the idea in time. And maybe one time they go to the tree of life and they eat, and then she turns to that other tree. Maybe she wades the stream and just looks it over with all these thoughts running through her head. She never really noticed how beautiful the fruit was, how delicious the fruit looked. The tree of life gives life, it gives health, it gives vitality. This tree gives wisdom, and wisdom's a good thing. God's a source of wisdom. And so we see the process of sin becoming attractive. Sin is made to look so good, so attractive. And we have every reason in the world to think that disobeying God is a good choice. I know he said not to do this, but it'd be better if I make my own choices. We can justify why disobedience is okay, even good. Maybe we suspect that God is withholding something good from us. And for us to have that good means we have to ignore him to reach it. Or maybe we suspect that, okay, God has a plan, God's working out his plan, and in his plan, maybe I'm a little pawn that can get used and discarded. And maybe in your heart of hearts, you're tempted to think that God sees you that way, that, okay, his plan's going to work out, but his plan is going to throw me under the bus. So if I'm going to have a fulfilled, satisfied life, I have to do it myself, because God's plan is too big for it to matter to me. Maybe he sees us overlooked and disposable. Maybe we have to assert ourselves to build our own life to find something truly fulfilling. Again, you'll be like God. She's made in God's image. That is her destiny. So you can almost sense the sense of destiny she might put into this, that I want to be like God. And so this is the good thing to do. This is the right thing to do. Every one of us have stood where Eve stands. Every one of us have looked at that fruit, whatever it is, whatever we're tempted to trade in place of God, saying, God says no, or maybe he said, you think God probably won't let me do this. I want to do it. And like Eve, we stand and we're convinced that fruit is everything we desire and it's within our grasp. And the only thing stopping us is God's quiet voice saying no. We're told that fruit is everything we want. Don't give in to the lie. That is the lie the world teaches you every single day. Don't give in to the lie. But let me ask you, maybe you've never asked yourself this question, is it really a lie? Because think about it. Everything the serpent said came true. Everything the serpent said happened. Do you ever notice that in this story? Someone said, you will not surely die. You're not going to die. And they didn't. They ate the fruit. They kept breathing. They were moving and planning and living after eating the fruit. The serpent said, you will not die on the day you eat of this. And they didn't. The serpent said, your eyes will be opened. And the very next verse, it says, and their eyes were opened. He delivered what he said he'd deliver. You eat this fruit, you'll have a new understanding. And they gained a new understanding. He said, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And if you read on farther in the passage, in the story, God says, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. It happened exactly as was promised. So was it a lie? Well, all lies contain some truth. And the strongest lie contains mostly truth, with just enough deception thrown in to poison the whole thing. Yes, he said, you will not die. And they didn't die, but they unleashed death in the world. From the moment they ate, from the moment they disobeyed, death was certain. And they could have had no way to grasp the onslaught of death that would follow them throughout history. And so we can read on in Scripture. Their son becomes the first murderer. And from there, as you read through the genealogies, one thing you'll notice over and over, it says, and he died. And so-and-so bore sons and daughters, and he died. And that son bore sons and daughters, and he died. And that death knell just echoes throughout history. The pages of Scripture, the pages of history. Everyone dies. So he said, you're not going to die. And they didn't, in one sense. But the reality was so much worse. They could have had no concept of murder, of suicide, of genocide, of the horrible things we have seen in our world when she believed, you won't die. Did she die? No, not right then. But here's the key. The fruit delivers, in many cases, all that it promises, but nothing that it offers. It may deliver on what it says, but there's a much greater sorrow coming. you will not die. He said, your eyes will be opened, and they were opened, but they were opened to shame. And suddenly, like a child whose innocence is ripped away, who discovers far too early that the world is cruel, that people are violent, suddenly they find their eyes opened and realize that they're naked and they're ashamed of it, because before this, they were innocent. And after this, suddenly shame becomes real. Yes, their eyes are opened, but the knowledge that brought is poison to them. He said, you'll be like God. You'll know good and evil. But here's the deal. They knew good. Everything they knew was good. What they learned was evil. And what they didn't know is evil and good cannot coexist. And so in learning and experiencing evil, it poisons all the good they had. Like a cancer spreading throughout their entire existence. Their greatest physical good was a tree of life. A tree to go and to eat from and have life restored and vitality restored. And as a consequence of disobedience, of knowing good and evil, that is cut off. They lose their greatest physical good in this world. Their greatest spiritual good is their relationship with God. God comes and walks with them and talks with them each evening, and they commune together. But now, when God shows up, we see Adam and Eve hiding in fear from God. They knew evil now. They knew good in memory, but now they know evil. Their greatest social or emotional, psychological benefit was each other. Can you imagine a perfect relationship? None of us have that. Newsflash. Some of us have good relationships. None of us have a perfect relationship. But guess what? What we see is after this, we see blaming each other. Adam says, the woman gave it to me. We see blame. We see excuses. No, don't blame. Don't make this about me. The serpent gave it to me. We see bickering right in the very heart of their most precious relationship. Yes, they got what they wanted. They became like God. They knew good and evil, but that knowledge poisoned everything about their existence. God knew what he was doing when he said, no, don't touch it. And they chose to just walk across that, and we've all paid and are still paying the consequences. If only they could turn back time. If only they could undo their choice. No doubt even the moment afterwards, they would have given anything to undo that choice. Had they had any inclination, any inkling of what history would bring, the heartache, the wars, the tragedies, oh, that they could have undone their choice. But they couldn't. But there was coming a time, there was coming a man, a second Adam, who would step into history, and he would undo what they did. He would offer the chance for restoration, for forgiveness, for a new start, and bit by bit undo everything that Adam and Eve did in their choice. That's what he offers us this morning. We can't go undo the evil in the world, but we can, in him, find victory over it. The fruit delivers all that it promised, but nothing it offers. Christ delivers everything he offers this morning. I'd like to conclude with a song, number 383. Let's stand. The song is Satisfied. It pictures